From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now. New York City may soon require employees and customers of private companies to be vaccinated against COVID-19 with no option to test out. Mayor Bill de Blasio calls it a preemptive strike against the Omicron variant. And epidemiologists say the concern is warranted. But our next guest reminds us that while Omicron merits caution and study, we can't forget about Delta. Let's bring in Dr. Peter Hotez. He's co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital, and he joins us by Skype. Dr. Hotez, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Well, first, your thoughts on this new vaccine mandate out of New York, which goes into effect a few days after Christmas. It also applies to customers over the age of 12 at indoor dining and fitness and entertainment and performance venues.
Well, I think it's important to separate out the any vaccine mandates from Omicron. In my opinion, even if Omicron was never in the picture, there's still justification for mandating vaccines. And it goes something like this. You know, this Delta variant is a bad actor. In the United States, since June 1 this year, 150,000 unvaccinated Americans have needlessly lost their lives to COVID because vaccines were widely available and they've chosen not to get vaccinated. You know, we call it misinformation or disinformation. It's the world's greatest self-immolation. People who could have easily gotten vaccinated, had widespread access to vaccinations, chose not to, for whatever reason you can imagine, and now lost their lives. And so Delta's coming back. The Delta variant hit down in Texas and in the South. It hit us very hard over the summer, just like COVID-19 did last year. And then you saw a big rise as we went into the winter. And now the numbers are going up again across the northern part of the United States. So for Delta alone, I think it's really critical we vaccinate these populations.
Right, for Delta alone, but Omicron might definitely be the impetus for a spike and people wanting to get vaccinated. Healthcare workers gave out more than 2.1 million doses on Thursday. That's the highest in a single day since May. But what do we know about how effective the vaccines are against this new variant?
Well, we don't have any specific data. It should be forthcoming pretty soon. But here's what we do know. Once you have two doses of the existing vaccines, if you got either the two mRNA vaccines, and you get that third dose when you're eligible, you get a 30 to 40 fold rise in your virus neutralizing antibody. So a big jump. And when you have that big elevation of virus neutralizing antibodies, it'll actually increase the likelihood that you'll have crossover protection, or what Tony Fauci calls spillover protection, against the Omicron variant. So the bottom line is, whether you're worried about Delta, worried about Omicron, that third immunization will certainly help against Delta, and overwhelmingly likely it'll help against Omicron as well. And we'll have confirmation of that, I think, over the next couple of weeks. Our lab, which has developed a recombinant protein COVID vaccine for India, is doing that, as is, you name it, Pfizer, J&J, and Moderna. The other thing that's really important that people don't quite understand is people who are infected and recovered think they have really strong durable protection. They do not. If you get vaccinated on top of that, you're twice as less likely to get reinfected with COVID as if you don't get vaccinated. And if you've been infected and recovered, what we're seeing with the Omicron variant are very high rates of Omicron reinfection. So both for Delta but especially for Omicron, if you've been infected and recovered, this is the time to get vaccinated, because that will also build in better protection and greater resilience against any new variants that come along. And then the last bit of recommendation is, get your kids vaccinated if they've not been vaccinated yet. We're still underperforming on that front.
Right, because folks are still waiting. I mean, they're eligible now for those under 12 years old. You know, I know that we're talking about Delta versus Omicron, but do you anticipate that one will eventually win out, as Delta did during the second year of this pandemic?
Well, you know, this has been the pattern we've seen, right? With the original lineage that came out of central China, it got replaced by the Alpha variant earlier this year. And then Alpha got replaced by Delta. Delta's been so far the king of all variants in terms of transmissibility. If Omicron is going to displace Delta, that's a pretty high bar. So what I would anticipate for a good part of this winter, we could have both variants in play, both Delta and Omicron. And with Omicron particularly effective at reinfecting individuals who've been infected and recovered, or those who've gotten two doses of vaccinated but have waning immunity and not gotten their third. So I would imagine both are going to be in play for at least a while. Whether Omicron totally outpaces Delta, as it seems to be doing in South Africa, it's very hard to say. You know, you have to keep in mind, so far the numbers are really small in Europe and the U.S. Last thing I'll say is you're hearing reports saying, oh my God, there's a doubling of the number of Omicron cases in the U.K. and Denmark. But you're talking about going from 100 cases to 200 cases in the context of 40,000 Delta infections. Yep. So you have to keep that in mind.
That's Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital. The message is get vaccinated. Thank you so much, Dr. Hotez.
Thanks so much.
To Omicron and the economy now, as American consumers are already dealing with an overloaded global supply chain. The Biden administration has tapped a new envoy to try to smooth out the snarls at ports including Long Beach and Los Angeles, which receive 40% of the country's goods. Thing is, ports in China are overloaded and understaffed, and Beijing is placing new restrictions on them. And every link in this global chain seems to affect everything else. So, how will this affect the holiday season, holiday shipping season and beyond? Let's talk to Paul Bingham. He's a transportation economist at IHS Markit. Paul, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be with you.
So, what do the bottlenecks look like now in the world supply chain? Any sense that the flow of factories and workers and container ships, ports, truck drivers is improving right now?
Yeah, I mean, we've gotten to the point in the peak season, I guess, before the end of the year where things have stopped getting worse, but that doesn't say much because they're horrendous. I mean, you know, you've still got enormous delays, not just at the ports, but all the way through the supply chains around the world.
Now, the critical country, as we know, in all of this is China. It has a more zero-tolerance governance approach to this pandemic. Now it plans to suspend services at certain Chinese ports late next week. Is that going to restrict the goods, slow the goods coming out to the rest of the world?
Yes, this is a repeat of what we've seen has happened earlier this year when individual Chinese ports or even individual port terminals have shut down. That has added to the delays that we're seeing at unprecedented levels in the supply chains. So it's not a new development in the sense that this has happened before, but it's not going to help improve the situation and probably will make for certain supply chain flows make things even worse, for at least for some period of time.
Now let's talk about Omicron here. We do know countries are restricting flights right now. When you look back, what have we learned about borders and closings and what governments might do this time when we learn more about this variant?
I don't know for sure, obviously, what's going to happen in terms of border closures to echo what we've seen in the previous waves, but we have learned through each of those waves that there's a psychological impact on purchasing behaviors, most associated with travel services, meaning people stop traveling when the borders are harder to cross or they're shut down, which has added to this problem with the supply chain and kept it really from resolving itself.
When you think about what U.S. authorities can do, I mean, to what degree can the U.S. government try to improve things, actually improve them a little bit?
Well, unfortunately for a lot of the policymakers in the very short run, there's not a whole lot they can do. They're not providers of the infrastructure. They don't provide the services. You know, there's a few key points that they participate in, such as the U.S. government has customs agents that have to clear goods that are brought into the country. But I think they've already tried to do all they can do to try to expedite that and not make that a bottleneck on top of all the other bottlenecks. But adding acreage or adding equipment or adding workers that are trained, all of that is not something that comes directly from the government. They can encourage it in the future. We've just seen some changes in the law regarding a potential eligibility to become a truck driver. You know, all of those sorts of policy steps can make a difference in the medium to the long term. But as far as solving the congestion you face right now to get those goods off a ship and where they need to go on a store shelf or to a fulfillment center for an e-commerce company, that is not something the government has a whole lot of power to make much much of a difference either way.
So should the American consumer buckle up for a rough 2022?
Well, the supply chain problems are definitely going to continue into the year. Now, if we get past this latest wave of virus and we don't shut down the economy, you know, like we have done before, if the vaccination rates increase incrementally, perhaps the confidence of the consumers will increase enough that they'll feel a little bit more normal, maybe not entirely compared to what there was in terms of behavior pre-pandemic, to start spending more on services and spending less on goods, in which case that really is the solution, is to have a purchasing pattern of income shift a little bit back more towards services to provide more jobs in the services sector and so forth, and have less pressure on the retailers trying to deliver all this stuff that people have been buying since the summer of 2020.
Paul Bingham is a transportation economist at IHS Markit. Paul, thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
The Supreme Court will likely deliver a decision on Mississippi's restrictive abortion law sometime in June. Mississippi bans abortions after 15 weeks, and the court's decision could go as far as overturning Roe v. Wade, paving the way for states to pass tighter restrictions and even ban abortion entirely. Well, a recent study explores what happens to women when they are denied access to abortion. Jabeli Karazana has been writing about this. She's an economy reporter for the 19th. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
So this study is called the Turnaway Study, and it was conducted by Diane Green Foster. She followed 1,000 women over a decade who were seeking an abortion. What were the key findings?
Yeah, this study is really interesting because it's really the first one that gives us a look into how the sort of economic aspect of an abortion, how this sort of falls into the calculus of the decisions folks make. And so of that group of 1,000 women, there was two subgroups. One group received an abortion. The other group was too far along to receive an abortion, were denied care depending on the states that they were living in. And so what we saw was that the second group, the group that was unable to get an abortion, it took them 4 years to catch up to the employment levels of the other group. About 72% of the women who didn't receive an abortion ended up living in poverty, compared to about half of the other group. And so what we saw was that many of these women had been seeking an abortion specifically because they did not feel that they were in a financially stable place to have a child. And then those who did not reach it fell deeper into poverty. They looked at credit reports for these women later on down the road and found that 78% increase in the amount of debt for those who did not get an abortion. 81% of those in that group had reports of bankruptcy, evictions, tax liens. And so this is sort of kind of the more tangible aspects that you can look at, where you can see the pieces where really it had kind of a chilling effect on their ability to advance economically.
Can you give us a sense of the demographics of the women who were most impacted?
Yes, we know that low-income women of color are the most likely to be severely impacted in these cases. It's folks that, you know, have less access to capital, maybe in jobs that are really precarious. They could lose those jobs. They might not have access to paid leave, to sick leave, to be able to leave to go even get the procedure. We've seen that play out this year in particular. And so we know that this group that is already marginalized, already does not has systemic barriers that they are facing to be able to get support, they suffer the most. And sort of it's sort of compounding what we see, particularly for communities of color.
There's some other findings as well. This study also found that women denied abortion had continuing mental health problems. Can you say more about those findings?
Yeah, the mental health piece is, I think, a really important one in all of this, because there is a lot tied up in your ability to be able to support your child. It gets really complicated because there's feelings of guilt. There's feelings of, you know, difficulty. You know, this is the reason I didn't want to have this child, because I was worried I was going to bring them into a life, you know, where they would be impoverished. And so, you know, we know that that has long-term effects. If you're a child that was born low, you know, into a low-wage family, it has long-term effects in your ability with education, with sort of long-term outcomes in your life. And so it's something that follows you for some time.
During the arguments in the Mississippi case last week, the Supreme Court appeared open to banning abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. How would that time limit impact the financial equation for women who are seeking an abortion?
Yeah, I think the thing that a lot of folks don't understand is 6 weeks, you are barely even aware of a pregnancy at that point in time. I mean, many people don't even have symptoms at that point in time. So it's a very, very, very tight window. And so if you're trying to seek an abortion and you're in a state that has one abortion clinic, which several states do, Missouri has one, Kansas has one, and especially if you don't have the resources to even get there, which for many folks, they're driving miles and miles and miles just to get to a clinic, and then oftentimes to have to return the next day or return in a few days because of additional rules around that, it becomes really sort of financially difficult even to get that care.
What you're talking about here are the individual ramifications. But zooming out a little bit here, we heard Department of Labor Secretary Marty Walsh tell the 19th that he was concerned the Texas abortion law could have dangerous consequences for employment and people's health. What are the broader economic impacts of limiting access to abortion? Your thoughts on this, especially after going through all of this data and research?
You know, it's time off work, it's lost earnings, it's increased turnover, it's labor force participation. All of these things are impacted. There was a study by the Institute of Women's Policy Research that found that state-level abortion restrictions can cost state economies about $105 billion a year. I was in Missouri and somebody said, you know, we're very pro-life in this region. This was their quote. But you want to protect the unborn baby, but we need to protect the baby that's born afterward. And so what is the support for these families once these children are born? And that's where it gets very tricky because there are ramifications in the front end, but also later on.
Jabeli Karazana is an economy reporter for the 19th. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we will have a link to the Turnaway study at hereandnow.org.
With the holiday season comes the spirit of giving. Well, what if you lived in a place where people give their gifts, their time, their favors all year round, expecting nothing in return? It exists. Kenny Cooper of member station WHYY reports on a movement known as Buy Nothing.
Lansdowne is a one-square-mile town in southeast Pennsylvania. It's home to more than 10,000 people and a thriving gift-giving economy with 1,400 members on Facebook. Buy Nothing Lansdowne is an offshoot of a growing nationwide internet campaign known as the Buy Nothing Project. The rules of participation are simple. As long as you live in Lansdowne, you may give, receive, lend, and borrow items or even acts of service for free, no strings attached.
You're able to, you know, purge yourself of items that you no longer need and know that they'll have a use in someone else's home.
That's Diane Echternach. Her mother-in-law, a lifelong Lansdowne resident, recently died, and clearing out her home has been tough. Echternach posted a Give in the Buy Nothing Facebook group, and her neighbor, Anna Gavin, who's also a page administrator, responded with interest. Soon, they were face-to-face on a cold Thursday morning, Gavin receiving the benefit of some silk scarves and pencils, Echternach receiving peace of mind.
I love my Buy Nothing community and wanted to see some of her items remain in Lansdowne. So that was, you know, definitely helpful for me.
Gifts and ask, as they're called in the group, can be as small as the scarves and pencils to as grand as entire furniture sets and even refrigerators. They can also be practical, like a ride to the train station or even friends to bike with. While members of the group may come for the goods, Gavin said they stay for something completely different, connecting with their neighbors.
I lived here in Lansdowne for 15 years, and we knew our immediate neighbors. We didn't know them well, and then we had kids, and then we, you know, kind of saw some people who had kids, but again, we didn't really connect that much. And then I joined the Buy Nothing group.
The Buy Nothing project began in 2013 when best friends Liesl Clark and Rebecca Rockefeller noticed waves of plastic washing up onto the shores of Bainbridge Island, Washington. They diagnosed the problem as overconsumption and waste, or simply put, too much stuff. What started off as a neighborhood social experiment to limit buying and throwing away things quickly grew. Bainbridge Island would soon see several Buy Nothing groups pop up, Clark says.
It's a much more sort of sustainable way of being, but you are weaving this web of interconnectedness that becomes more and more sort of intricate, but more sort of fascinating over time because we come to know each other through our stuff.
Since then, the project has taken off in 44 countries with more than 4 million participants in 6,800 Buy Nothing groups like the one in Lansdowne. Colleen Johnson of Buy Nothing Ambler, Bluebell, Lower Gwinnett, neighborhoods just north of Philadelphia, says that part of the benefit of being an administrator is being able to see the inner workings of other groups. That's where she saw her favorite thing gifted.
Someone's relative was going into hospice, and he wanted peanut butter Girl Scout cookies. And it wasn't Girl Scout season time, and one of my members had them in the freezer. And so I took them from her, and I drove it to her, and she brought it to her relative. So it was like a little train, but we were able to fulfill someone's last request and didn't cost anybody anything.
Acts of generosity and gift-giving may have slowed down a bit early in the pandemic, but it brought out the best of Buy Nothing Lansdowne. Take mother and daughter Jillian and Caroline Lancaster. Both are self-employed graphic designers. Caroline was bored, and her mom needed help cleaning out her Lansdowne house. So Caroline moved in. They soon found a way to leverage the generosity of Buy Nothing to assist the Lansdowne community. With the help of their neighbors, they fashioned their porch into a makeshift food pantry where people could drop off and pick up food. Caroline says she believes that giving should be thought of as an act of service to the community.
And it's so nice to reframe giving instead of a reciprocal thing. Like, I'm giving you something to show you how I care about you. It's just kind of, you're my town, you know I love you, so let's take care of each other. Why not?
For Here and Now, I'm Kenny Cooper.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
One of the country's biggest banks says it will no longer charge customers for overdrawing their accounts. Capital One says it's getting rid of overdraft charges next year for some customers after criticism that the fees are exploitive. Here to tell us more is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money. Welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Yes, Jill. So Capital One makes quite a bit of money off of these fees, about $150 million a year. How do you think they're thinking about these losses? Do you think they're banking on maybe getting new customers to offset this move?
You know, maybe that's one issue. Maybe they want to get ahead of what they see as new regulation that could be coming on the horizon. I just think it's hard to speculate on their motivation. But I guess the really good news is that Capital One is going to completely eliminate these overdraft fees and non-sufficient fund fees for its consumer banking customers as early as next year. So I think that's kind of the good news. I can't ascribe their motive, though.
Yeah. Overdrafts really affect credit scores. So what does this actually mean for Capital One customers? Do they all get this benefit? Is this some kind of catch here with it? Who's eligible?
Well, according to the company, because they put a big release out, they said the new policy will take effect in early 2022 for customers who are currently enrolled in overdraft protection. So this is usually about $35 a year that people pay just to say, okay, don't put me into that place so that I have to pay the fee. Now, anyone who is in that overdraft protection pool will automatically be converted into a no-fee policy early next year. So you get to save the $35. Now, customers are also going to get free overdraft protection at that time. Now, let's say you're not enrolled in this program. Transactions that would overdraw your account will be declined, but the good news is no fees would be assessed. So I think this policy should really help a lot of the banking customers at Capital One.
You mentioned possible changes in regulation on the horizon. We don't know. That's just speculation. But do you expect other banks to follow suit?
I mean, there is a lot of revenue to lose. You mentioned $150 million from Capital One itself. Well, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says that big banks rely heavily on overdraft and these insufficient funds revenue. We're talking about almost $15.5 billion in 2019. So there's a new director of the CFPB, Rohit Chopra, and he says the bank's reliance on fee revenue, he says it's almost like an addiction. And he pointed to JPMorgan Chase and Wells Fargo and Bank of America. He says they're kind of like the big guys, and we'd like to see them do it. So I don't know if there's going to be any regulation, but he name-checked these banks. And if I were those banks, I'd start to be thinking like, maybe we shouldn't be doing this anymore.
Mm-hmm. I have about 30 seconds with you. The Biden administration is set to resume payments on federal student loans in January. Are Americans ready to start paying?
Some of them are, some of them are not. We have some data from the Department of Ed that says about 7.7 million student loan borrowers in the U.S. were behind on payments at the start of the pandemic. 93% of them are still behind. Go to studentaid.gov and start reading up on what you need to do before these changes go back into effect end of January.
That's Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money. As always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
COVID-19 is again surging in parts of the country, primarily due to the Delta variant. And of course, the new Omicron variant is spreading too. Officials are again urging vaccinations, and shots are now authorized for kids as young as 5. But here's the thing. A poll from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 30% of parents with kids aged 5 to 11 want to wait and see. And another 30% say flat out, no, we don't plan to vaccinate our young kids at all. Now, one reason for this hesitancy may be something called omission bias. Psychologist Gretchen Chapman is here to tell us more. She has the Department of Social and Decision Sciences at Carnegie Mellon University. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, we know there is misinformation about COVID-19 vaccines, but also a cognitive bias that could be in play that psychologists call omission bias. Does that mean, you know, if I have a choice between doing something and not doing it, and both have risk, I may lean toward not?
Yes, exactly. It means that harm that is caused by commission is viewed as worse than harm that results from omission, even if the magnitude of the harm is the same.
Why is that? I mean, especially with vaccines, is there evidence that, say, if I'm a parent, I might feel more guilty for actively choosing something that could do something wrong?
Yeah, I do think that guilt and responsibility is part of it. Omission bias is generally measured through giving people a scenario, usually a hypothetical scenario. Hmm. Quite a few years ago, I did a study where I gave some university employees a scenario about a new disease we called nauseosis and told them they had a 10% chance of getting this new disease. And there was also a vaccine against the disease, which was completely effective at eliminating the risk of getting the new disease. But the vaccine itself could, in rare cases, cause the disease itself. And a lot of participants would not accept the vaccine, even if it led to a lower risk of the disease. And furthermore, the people that showed this omission bias pattern in our scenario, they were less likely to get a flu shot in real life.
Wow. And I guess to step back, is this part of a broader field of study that suggests that all of us, we humans, may not be as rational as we think we are?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is what I think about all day long, every day, is how do humans make decisions and how do those decisions deviate from rational standards? So the rational standard here would be harm reduction. You know, how do you engage in the course of behavior that's going to reduce your total risk of harm? And in our scenario, that was getting the vaccine. And of course, all the evidence indicates that in real life, that would also be getting the COVID vaccine, that your risk of harm is much lower if you vaccinate than if you don't vaccinate. But we humans have a tendency to take more responsibility or feel more regret or guilt if the harm is caused by an action that we took rather than a harm just occurring independent of our action, even if there was an action we could have taken to prevent it.
Is there a lot of evidence that this omission bias exists with regard to vaccines in real life? We've, of course, have had so many vaccines in the last few decades.
Well, it's interesting that a lot of the research on the omission bias that uses these scenarios, the scenarios have, are almost always about vaccination. John Barron and Alana Ritoff pioneered the work on this omission bias. And I think the reason that they started looking at it in the context of vaccines is because there are some live vaccines like the oral polio vaccine where the vaccine itself can cause the disease. Let me emphasize that the COVID vaccine is not like that. You cannot get COVID from the COVID vaccine. There are some vaccines in our history that did have that feature, and that makes it sort of a perfect setup for studying this distinction between omission and commission.
So are there ways to overcome this omission bias that we all may have? I'm sure you and I have been in a lot of conversations where the suggestion is, well, let's just keep hammering people with facts and with evidence, and that'll do it.
Well, the omission-commission bias results from treating, of course, omissions and commissions differently. And the way to avoid it is to think about any choice as an action. So if you choose not to act, you're still making a choice. So I don't have any data on this, but I'm sort of thinking about what would happen if, rather than just not showing up to the vaccination clinic, if you didn't want to vaccinate or you didn't want to get your kid vaccinated, you actually had to make an active choice. You had to, I don't know, show up to the clinic anyway, but then once you get there, make an explicit expression of the fact that you weren't going to get vaccinated. That makes it seem more like you're making an active move there. And then how would you feel if later you got COVID after you actively went to the clinic and said, no, I'm here and I don't want my vaccine?
I see. So that is the decision to take some action is actually opting out, whereas opting in is kind of the norm. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Omissions are kind of by their nature more passive. You might not get vaccinated just because you forgot or you didn't get around to it or you weren't thinking about it. But if you were cued to actively decline the vaccine, then it's not really an omission anymore, right? It's more of an action. And because we think that the omission bias is driven in part by this feelings of regret or guilt if a bad outcome happens later, it's possible that your feelings of regret after actively turning down the vaccine and then getting sick would be different than if you just sort of passively avoided the vaccine and then later got sick.
I wonder then, this choice, the way you describe, is being presented to a lot of us, say, federal government workers. Right, they have to do this unless they get an exemption or give a good reason.
Mm-hmm.
More
mm-hmm.
companies are doing the same thing. The default is to get the vaccine. So in a way, is society with these vaccines potentially kind of moving toward this choice architecture that you're talking about?
Yeah, I really like that connection that you're drawing. That is indeed one thing that a vaccine mandate does is you can't passively avoid the vaccine. If you don't want to get vaccinated, you have to explicitly ask your employer or organization to give you an exemption. And of course, we've seen that when mandates are instituted, vaccination rates do go up. And there could be a lot of reasons for that, of course, but possibly it's because it's turning that omission into a commission.
Now, behavioral science suggests we all just struggle to weigh risk in general. Why?
Risk is very difficult to evaluate for individuals because it doesn't map directly onto our experience. So sort of by definition, you have to rely on scientific data to really understand low probability risky events. And our cognitive systems didn't evolve to be able to understand scientific data easily. Our cognitive systems evolved to understand our own experience. And our experience is almost always too small of a data set. So, you know, we're now almost 2 years into this pandemic. I, to my knowledge, have not contracted COVID during that time. What I would learn from my experience is that the world is pretty safe. I haven't gotten it so far. How risky could it be? But that would be the wrong conclusion for me to come to.
Gretchen Chapman is the head of the Department of Social and Decision Sciences at Carnegie Mellon University. Professor Chapman, thanks so much for the time.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
Let's take a minute now to remember a country music legend.
Waterloo, Waterloo.
Stonewall Jackson died Saturday at the age of 89. You're listening to Waterloo, one of his biggest hits released in 1959. He was also known for hits like A Wound, Time Can Erase, and BJ the DJ. Stonewall Jackson was born in North Carolina in 1932, and in case you're wondering, that really was his name. He was named after the Confederate general whom his father said the family was related to. Jackson joined the Grand Ole Opry early in his career without a record deal and stayed there for more than 60 years. He spoke with Music Charts magazine in 2013 about how much it meant to belong.
The Grand Ole Opry, although I'm not putting down the record end of the business because that's very important too, but to me, the way I came here and all, the Grand Ole Opry has been the mainstay in my career. And I still love the Grand Ole Opry very, very much.
The love is mutual. Jackson will be honored in a performance at the Opry this weekend.
Known as Bonaparte's Retreat, and that's when Napoleon met his Waterloo.
In the global effort to fight climate change, China pledged to reduce its reliance on fossil fuels. But this year, facing long power shortages, the country is actually increasing its use of coal. NPR's Emily Fang brings us the story from the heart of China's coal country.
The sharp, lowest hills of China's Shanxi province hide fortunes in coal. This plant in Heding County is accessible only by winding mountain roads, and it is flush with coal. Trucks line up on ground dark with coal dust, each waiting patiently to receive its load of precious black cargo. Driver Yuan Fuping watches as a tractor dumps huge piles of thermal coal into his truck. Last year, he says coal prices were so low he didn't work at all. This year, Yuan is getting paid double to drive the coal to a power station where it'll be burned to generate electricity. Drivers like Yuan are back at work because prices for coal, especially the kind destined for power plants, are at a premium this year. And Shanxi province, China's Appalachia, if you will, is now a hive of activity. Coal mines are back at capacity, coal imports are ramping up, and coal is being stockpiled. This plant director says producers like him were ordered to ensure a national stockpile of thermal coal. He didn't want to go on record because the topic is considered politically sensitive. He points to a huge depot filled with coal behind him and complains he's having difficulty selling it all while prices are still high. This coal surge is a step backward for a country that wants to use less coal. This year, analysts estimate China will burn about 4% or 160 million tons more coal than the year before. Why is this? Well, first, a jump in power demand. As China's economy recovered, demand for goods produced there has surged. And second, COVID. To understand that, we need to zoom out and look outside China to Mongolia. Our livelihood depends completely on selling coal to China, says Naren Setseg Nyamjov, the manager of Mongolian coal transport business. Mongolian coal is more needed than ever in China because China cut off Australia, its other source of coal imports, as political punishment. But China has also shut its borders to Mongolia to stop COVID transmission. And to ferry coal to China, Mongolian drivers must first live in sealed quarantine bubbles, really just tent camps, to prove they do not have the virus. Mongolian driver Dava Soren Taksai Khan says in his bubble, people have quarantined for 2 to 3 months just to drive coal into China and earn a paycheck. Mongolian coal exports to China have plummeted to just a third of what they were last year, pushing Chinese coal prices even higher. China has also tried to boost its own coal production, but it spent years closing down smaller, dirtier, unsafe mining facilities, meaning it can't just press a button and order more coal to be produced. The upside is, this year's power shortages have made it painfully clear to Beijing it needs to accelerate power reform measures.
And frankly, measures that environmental groups, progressive think tanks have been advocating for the last two decades.
This is Li Shuo, a senior campaigner and carbon expert at China's Greenpeace office. He's talking about long-awaited measures which finally allow flexibility in setting electricity prices. Before, the state set prices once a year. Now, the power market is liberalized.
And what will a more liberalized power market do? It will make coal price less competitive than, for example, the price of renewable energy sources.
Meaning coal-fired electricity prices are now allowed to rise to reflect higher coal prices, while renewables will get even cheaper in China.
So I think that's going to provide a pretty substantive economic incentive for China to embrace more wind and solar projects.
While that happens, coal still remains king. This conundrum between the need for coal and the desire to use less of it is exemplified by coal trader Li Lianchao. He buys up wholesale coal directly from the mines in Shanxi's Hejin County and sells it to power plants and steel mills. And this year, he says, has been a roller coaster. He says the coal shortage was so dire, everyone was competing to buy coal low and sell high, which meant he made some money. But now he says the power sector reforms have kicked in, which means the long-term commercial outlook for coal looks dim. That is why Li is looking to change jobs next year. Coal, he says, is no longer the future. Emily Fang, NPR News, Shanxi Province, China.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now.